Common life is filled with them, as you know better than anyone I have ever met. You, who see his light and life in the dullest blade of grass, have taught my own eye to look for and find his magnitude abounding everywhere. Though you are merely steps away, beyond the hedge, I long for you as if you were in Persia, and yet your presence is with me. Your very fragrance clings to the shirt I wear. I have given my heart completely only once, and it was to him. Now he has, himself, set aside in my heart a room for you. It is large and open and suffused with light, with no walls or boundaries to stifle us. And he has graciously fashioned it to give us warmth and shelter and joyous freedom until the end of our days. May this be only the first of many times. I thank you for all you are to me, and for the precious and inimitable gift of your love. Please know that I shall set a watch upon myself to make every effort to bring you the happiness you so richly deserve, and, by his grace, to place your needs before my own. May God bless you with his greatest tenderness, now and always, my sweetheart, my soon-to-be wife, Timothy. He sat as if drained. There was nothing left of him, nothing at all. He was parchment through which light might be seen. Barnabas, he murmured. His good dog stirred at his feet. I have a mission for you, old friend. He folded the letter, regretting that he'd written it on paper from a mere notepad. Ah, well, what was done was done. He placed the letter in an envelope and thought carefully how he might address it. In a letter, hidden inside an envelope, one might say whatever one wished. But the outside of the envelope was quite another thing, being completely exposed, as it were, to what? The hedge? The sky? My love, my blessing, my neighbor, he scrawled with some abandon. He licked the flap and pressed it down, and sat for a moment with it under his hand, then took it to the kitchen and found a length of twine, which he looped around the neck of his patient dog. Lacking a hole punch, he stuck the tip of a steak knife through the corner of the envelope and ran the twine through the hole and tied it in a knot. There, he said aloud. He walked with Barnabas down the back steps and across the yard to the hedge. Okay, boy, take it to Cynthia. Barnabas lifted his leg against a rhododendron. Take it to Cynthia, he said, wagging his finger in the direction of the little yellow house. Over there. Go see Cynthia. Barnabas turned and looked at him with grave indifference.
Cat, he hissed. Cynthia's house. Cat, cat, cat.
That ought to do it. Barnabas sniffed a few twigs that lay in the grass, then sat down and scratched vigorously. Rats, what a dumb idea. In the old days, a fellow would have sent his valet or his coachman or some such, and here he was trying to send a dog. He deserved what he was getting.
Go, dadgummit. Go to Cynthia's back door. That's where you love to go when you're not supposed to.
Barnabas gazed at him for a moment, then turned and bounded through the hedge and across her yard and up the steps to her stoop, where he sat and pressed his nose against the screen door, peering in. He suddenly felt 10 years old. Why couldn't he think straight for 5 minutes in a row? His dog might sit at that door till kingdom come, with Cynthia having no clue Barnabas was out there. Should he run to the door and knock to alert her, then run away again? This was suddenly the most ridiculous mess he'd gotten himself into in ever. His face flamed. Timothy? It was Cynthia calling to him through her studio window. He'd utterly forgotten about her studio window.
Yes. Why are you hiding behind the hedge?
He was mortified. I have no idea, he wanted to say.
There's a delivery, he fairly thundered the word, at your back door.
Oh, she said. He waited, covering his face with his hands.
My goodness, he heard her exclaim as she opened the screen door. A letter on a string.
Surely he would regret this.
My love, my blessing, my neighbor, she crowed.
Did she have to inform the whole neighborhood?
Go tell your master that I've received his most welcome missive, which I can barely get off the string.
Ugh! Oh, poop, wait till I get the scissors. His dog waited.
And further, she said, coming back and snipping the letter off, do tell him I shall endeavor to respond promptly. However, my dear Barnabas, do not harbor, even for a moment, the exceedingly foolish hope that it will be delivered by Violet.
The screen door slapped behind her.
The deed done, his dog arose, shook himself, and came regally down the steps, across the yard and through the hedge, where, wearing the remains of the twine around his neck, he sat and gazed at his master with a decided air of disdain, if not utter disgust.
Chapter 7. The Prayer. She pressed the letter to her heart, wishing the power of its message to enter her very soul, and cause her to believe with the writer what an extraordinary benediction had come to them. Yes, she loved him, in truth, more than life itself, and yet the fear was beginning to creep in, the fear she had at last grown wise enough to recognize, that she could not please him and give him the joy that he above all others deserved, the fear that Timothy, like Eliot, would not find her valuable enough for any true purpose, the fear that her priest, her neighbor, and now her betrothed, might discover in her some terrible lack, as Eliot had called her inability to bear children. Only weeks earlier, she had wept in despair that Timothy Cavanaugh would ever be able to abandon his own raw fear and surrender his heart. Now she bowed her head and wept because at last he had. She stood at the kitchen sink, spooning an odorous lump of congealed cat food into Violet's dish. Drawing her breath sharply, she stared at the cat bowl that she had just filled without knowing it. She felt stricken. What had she done when she accepted his proposal with such unbearable eagerness and joy? Had she rashly agreed to something in which she might prove a bitter disappointment to both Timothy and herself? And another thing, could she, who had often felt thrown away, be a friend and guide to a thrown-away boy? She thought she could. She knew she wanted to, for Dooley's sake and her own. She put the bowl on the floor and walked down the hall to her studio and stood at the window, gazing across the hedge to the rectory. There was his stone chimney, his slate roof, his bedroom window beneath the gable. How often she had found solace in merely looking upon his house, the place where he would be working in his study, snoring by his fire, brushing his dog, commandeering his wayward boy, living his life. She began by having the most terrific crush on him, like a pathetic schoolgirl. It had been the sort of thing that made her blush at the sight of him, and caused her skin to tingle when she heard his voice. Worse, there had been long lapses of concentration that afflicted her for months on end. She had plotted ways to meet him on the street, and once thumped onto the bench in front of the Main Street grill, affecting a turned ankle that delayed her jaunt to the local. He had, indeed, come by, just as she'd hoped, and sat with her and smiled at her in a way that made her nearly speechless, until, finally, she fled the bench, forgetting to limp, and avoided him altogether for several weeks. She remembered, too, the day she had prayed and marched boldly to his back door. Her heart thundered under her jumper
as she asked to borrow a cup of sugar to make a cake. Having no intention of making a cake, she worried whether, in some priestly way, he might see through such guile and find her out. But he had invited her in, and fed her from the remains of his own supper, and she had seen something in his eyes, some kindness that had nearly broken her heart with its plainness and simplicity. And then his dog, attached to the handle of the silver drawer by a leash, had yanked the drawer out, sending forks, knives, and spoons clattering about the kitchen and skidding into the hallway. They had dropped to their knees as one, hooting with laughter as they collected the errant flatware. Even then, she knew that something had been sealed between them, and that it was laughter that had sealed it. It had been years since Elliot walked out. The divorce papers arrived by certified mail the following day, and in those years, not one soul had made her mouth go dry as cotton and her knees turn to water. Oh, how she had despised the torment of loving like a girl instead of like a sophisticated woman, whatever that might be. That early, awkward time had also been irresistibly sweet. But now this confusion and distress and alarm, and yes, the oddly scary thoughts of the women of Lord's Chapel, who for years had stood around him like a hedge of thorns, protecting him as their very own, keeping him, they liked to believe, from foolish stumbles, feeding him meringues and layer cake at every turn, mothering and sistering him as if this were their life's calling. She saw now something she'd only glimpsed before, and that was the way an unmarried priest is thought to belong to the matrons of the church, lock, stock, and barrel. More than once she'd waited at his side, feeling gauche and adolescent as they clucked over him, inquiring after his blood sugar, flicking an imaginary hair from his lapel, ordering him to take a week off, and coyly insisting he never stray beyond the town limits. They were perfectly harmless, every one, and she despised herself for such cheap and petty thoughts. But they were real thoughts, and now that the word was out, she felt his flock sizing her up in a fresh, even severe way. Yet, for all their maternal indulgence of their priest, she knew they underestimated him most awfully. She had heard a member of the altar guide wondering how anyone, so youthful and sure of herself, could be so attracted to their dear old priest who is going bald as a hen egg and diabetic to boot. Indeed, he wasn't merely the mild and agreeable man they perceived him to be. He was, instead, a man of the richest reserves of strength and poise, of the deepest tenderness, and most enormous wit and gallantry. From the beginning, she found him to possess an ardor for his calling that spoke to her heart and mind and soul in such a deep and familiar way. She felt as if he were long-lost kin, returned at last from a distant shore. He had felt this, too, this connection of some vital force in himself with her own vitality, and he had been knocked back, literally, as if by the thunder-striking power of a summer storm. She had known she would never again be given such a connection, and she had moved bravely toward it, toward its heat, toward its center, while he had drawn back, shaken. "Love bade me welcome," he had once quoted from George Herbert, "but my soul drew back." She found a delicate irony in the fact that George Herbert had been a clergyman. She looked at the handwritten sheet pinned above her drawing board, something she had copied at the Mitford Library from an old book by Elizabeth Googe. She had long accepted the fact that happiness is like swallows in spring. It may come and nest under your eaves, or it may not. You cannot command it. When you expect to be happy, you are not. When you don't expect to be happy, there is suddenly Easter in your soul, though it be midwinter. Something, you do not know what, has broken the seal upon that door in the depth of your being that opens upon eternity. Eternity. She moved from the window and walked quickly to the kitchen. She would do something that, if only for the briefest hour, had the power to solve everything, to offer certain and absolute consolation. She would cook. She removed the chicken from the refrigerator, already rubbed with olive oil and crushed garlic, with half a lemon tucked into its cavity. She misted olive oil into her ancient iron skillet, placed the bird on its back, and ground pepper and sea salt onto its plump flesh. From a glass of water on the windowsill, she removed a pungent stalk of fresh rosemary and stuck it under the breast skin. The top of the green stalk waved forth like a feather from a hatband. She turned the stove dial to 450, where it would remain for 30 minutes, before being set at 350 for an hour, and slid the raw feast onto the middle rack. The wrenching thing, she knew in her heart, was having no one to talk with about it all. And whose fault was that but her own? Had she not worked like a common stevedore since coming to Mitford, making a way for her work instead of making friends? Oh, yes, she was liked well enough. She really was. But there was no trusted friend to whom she might pour her heart out. There was no one, not a soul. Except, she smiled at the thought, the priest himself. Her heart warmed suddenly and lifted up. Hadn't she confessed something to him only yesterday? "They don't like me," she had said, despising the whine she heard in her voice. "They did, of course, until they learned you were actually going to marry me, but now..." "Nonsense," he'd said with feeling. "They think the world of you." That was apparently the most profound compliment a Southerner could pay, to insist that one was thought the world of. She realized she wouldn't finish the illustration as she'd promised her editor. She would finish it tomorrow instead. She, who was ever loath to break a promise, would break this one. "Timothy," she said when he answered the phone, "can you come over?" Her heart was pounding, and there was a distinct quaver in her voice. She was warbling like a canary. "I'm scared, dearest. Scared to death." She loved the way he sat with her, not saying anything in particular, not probing, not pushing her, just sitting on her love seat. Perhaps what she liked best was that he always looked comfortable wherever he was, appearing glad to live within his skin and not always jumping out of it like some men, like James, her editor, who was everlastingly clever and eloquent and ablaze with wild ideas that succeeded greatly for him, while with Timothy the thing that succeeded was quietude, something rich and deep and nourishing, a kind of spiritual chicken soup simmering in some far reach of the soul. "Tell me," he said at last. "Tell me everything. I'm your priest, after all." She thought his smile dazzling. A dazzling thing to come out of quietude. She had pulled a footstool to the love seat and sat close to him. "I'm terribly afraid I can't make you happy," she said. "But that was my fear. I finally kicked it out the back door, and now it's run over here." "It's not funny, Timothy." "I'm not laughing." He took her hands in his and lightly kissed the tips of her fingers, and she caught the scent of him, the innocence of him, and her spirit mounted up again. "Why don't we pray together?" he said. "Just let our hearts speak to his." Sitting at his feet, she bowed her head and closed her eyes, and he stroked her shoulder. Though the clock ticked in the hallway, she supposed that time was standing still and that she might sit with him in this holy reverie forever. "Lord," he said simply, "here we are."
"Yes, Lord, here we are."
They drew in their breath as one and let it out in a long sigh, and she realized for a moment how the very act of breathing in his presence was balm. "Dear God," he said, "deliver your cherished one from feeling helpless to receive the love you give so freely, so kindly, from the depths of your being. Help us
to be as large as the love you've given us. Sometimes it's too great for us, Lord, even painful in its power. Tear away the old fears, the old boundaries that no longer contain anything of worth or importance, and by your grace, make Cynthia able to seize this bold, fresh freedom. Yes, Lord, she prayed, the freedom I've never really known before, but which you faithfully shown me in glimmers, in epiphanies, in wisps as fragile as light from your new moon. He pressed her hand, feeling in it the beating of her pulse. Father, deliver me from the fear to love wholly and completely. I, who chided this good man for his own fears, his own weakness, while posing, without knowing it, a pose, as confident and bold. You've seen through that, Lord. You've found me out for what I am. There was a long silence, filled by the ticking of the clock. A frightened 7-year-old who stands at the door looking for a father and mother who do not come home. Even after years of knowing you as a father who is always home, I sometimes feel a prisoner of old and wrenching fears, and I'm ashamed of my fear and the darkness that prevents me from stepping into the light. You tell us in your word, he prayed, that you do not give us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and a sound mind, she whispered, completing the verse from the second letter to Timothy. And so, Lord, I rebuke the enemy who would employ every strategy to deny your children the blessing of your grace. Yes, Lord. Help us to receive your peace and courage, your confidence and power, he said. Yes, Lord. Thank you for being with us now, and in the coming weeks and coming years. And Father, she said, please give me the grace to love Dooley as you love him, and the patience to encourage and support and understand him, for I wish with all my heart that we might grow together in harmony as a true family. She took a deep and satisfying breath. And now, Lord, as the prayer neared its end, they spoke in unison as they had recently begun to do in their evening prayers. Create in us a clean heart, renew a right spirit within us, and fill us with your Holy Spirit, through Christ our Lord. Amen. He helped her from the footstool, and she sat beside him on the love seat and breathed the peace that settled over them like a shawl. There will be many times when fear breaks in, he said, holding her close. We can never be taken prisoner if we greet it with prayer. Yes, she whispered, feeling a weight rolled away like the stone from the sepulchre. I smelled the chicken as I came through the hedge.
Dinner in 20 minutes, she murmured.
I thought you'd never ask, he said. Chapter 8. The Preamble. On the morning of September 7th, in the upstairs guest room of the rectory, Bishop Stuart Cullen checked his vestments for any signs of wrinkles or unwanted creases, found none, then took his mitre from the box and set it on the bureau, mindful that his crozier was in the trunk of the car, as were his black, polished church shoes and an umbrella in case of rain. Rummaging about the room in a pair of magenta boxer shorts given him by his suffragan, he hummed snatches of a Johnny Cash tune as Martha Cullen sat up in bed and read an issue of Country Life magazine that Puny had placed on the night table 3 years ago and faithfully dusted ever since. Studying a feature on knot gardens, she was utterly unmindful of the bishop's rendition of Ring of Fire as he enjoyed a long, steaming shower that caused water in the shower across the hall to trickle upon the rector's head in a feeble stream. Under the miserly drizzle, the rector counted his blessings that the bishop would be preaching this morning and he celebrating, a veritable holiday in the Caymans as far as he was concerned. In truth, he feared that if he opened his mouth to deliver wisdom of any sort, it would pour forth as some uncertified language, resulting not from the baptism of the Holy Spirit, but of something akin to panic, or worse. He despaired that the custard had vanished in the night, and fear and trembling had jumped into its place with both feet. In his room across the hall, Dooley sat on the side of his bed and felt the creeping, lopsided nausea that came with the aroma of baking ham as it rose from the kitchen. He said 3 four-letter words in a row, and was disappointed when his stomach still felt sick. He hoped his voice wouldn't crack during the hymn. Though he'd agreed to sing a cappella, he didn't trust a cappella. If you hit a wrong note, there was nothing to cover you. He wished there were trumpets or something really loud behind him. But no, Cynthia wanted Dooley's pure voice. Gag.
"God," he said aloud, "don't let me sound weird. Amen."
He had no idea that God would really hear him or prevent him from sounding weird, but he thought it was a good idea to ask. He guessed he was feeling better about stuff. Yesterday, Father Tim spent the whole day taking him places, plus they'd run 2 miles with Barnabas and gone to Sweet Stuff after. Then Cynthia had given him a hug that nearly squeezed his guts out.
"Dooley," she said, "I really care about you."
When he heard that, he felt his face getting hard. He didn't want it to, but it was trained that way. He could tell she really meant it, but she'd have to prove she meant it before he would smile at her. He knew she wanted him to smile. Maybe he would someday, but not now. Now he was trying to keep from puking up his gizzard, because he had to sing a song he didn't even like at a wedding he still wasn't sure of. In the kitchen of the little yellow house beyond the hedge, Cynthia Coppersmith stood barefoot in her aging chenille robe, her hair in pink foam curlers, eating half a hot dog from the refrigerator, and drinking coffee so strong it possessed the consistency of tapioca. On arriving home last night from the country club dinner party, where, out of courtesy, she'd picked at a salad, she had boiled a hot dog and eaten the first half of it in a bun with what she thought was mustard, but was in fact horseradish, loosely the age of her expiring Boston fern. It was the first true nourishment she'd recently been able to take, except for a rock shrimp and 3 cherry tomatoes at Friday's bridal luncheon. She ate the remains of the hot dog in 2 bites, and feeling her lagging appetite suddenly stimulated, foraged in the refrigerator until she found a piece of Wednesday's broiled flounder, which she spritzed with the juice of a geriatric lemon, and standing at the sink, consumed with gusto. 2 blocks south, Esther Bolick peered out her kitchen window as a straggle of rain clouds parted to reveal the sun.
"Happy is the bride the sun shines on," she announced with relief.
Going briskly to the oven, she removed 3 pans of scratch cake layers to a cooling rack and stood with her hands on her hips in a baby doll nightgown and bedroom shoes with the faces of bunnies. She gazed with satisfaction at the trio of perfect yellow moons, then trotted across the kitchen for another cup of decaf, the black pupils of the bunnies' plastic eyes rolling and clicking like dice. She would go to Sunday school and the 11 o'clock, then come home and ice the cake and let it sit till she carried it to church at 4. She and Jean would do what they usually did when hauling around a 3-layer, put newspaper on the floor of the trunk, and while Jean drove, she would sit back there on a stool and hold the cake to keep it from sliding around in its cardboard box. Without a van, there was no way on God's green earth to follow her calling, unless you were making sheet cakes, which she utterly despised and would not be caught dead doing. The icing would go on at home, but she'd put the pearls and lilies on at church in one of the Sunday school rooms. Then she'd take the shelves out of the church fridge and pop the whole thing in till just before the thundering horde hit the reception. She removed the hairnet from her head and stuck it in the knife drawer. 4 blocks north, Uncle Billy Watson took the wire hanger from the nail on the wall and squinted at the black wool suit. inherited from his long-dead brother-in-law. Its heaviness had bowed down the arms of the coat hanger, giving the whole thing a dejected appearance.
"Dad gummit,"
he said under his breath. There was a spot on the right lapel as big as a silver dollar. It looked like paint, or was it vanilla pudding? In his pajamas, he shuffled to the kitchen, where he could see in a better light. Miss Rose was sitting in her chair by the refrigerator, peeling potatoes with a knife too dull to cut butter. "What are you doing, Bill Watson?"
"Cleaning my coat."
"You'll not be getting my goat," she said, indignant.
His wife was going deaf as a doorknob, and there wasn't a thing he could do about it. She wouldn't even discuss hearing aids, let alone ask the county to buy her a pair.
"What are you wearing to the wedding?"
he shouted.
"What wedding?"
"A preacher's wedding this evening at 5 o'clock.
5 o'clock?
She squawked.
"That's supper time."
"Well, I can't help it if it is. It's a preacher's wedding, and we're going."
Hadn't he talked about this wedding till he was blue in the face, even picked out 3 dresses she had bitterly rejected, and now this? He wagged his head and sighed.
"Lord have mercy." "What about Percy?"
she demanded. The old man scrubbed at the lapel with a wet dish rag. Some days he could put on a smiley face and go about his business just fine. Some days Rose Watson tested his faith. Yes, she did. He'd have to trot to church this morning and sit there asking forgiveness for what he was thinking. He'd also be thanking the Lord for the joke. Don't tell him that God Almighty didn't answer foolish prayers. 4 blocks northwest, Hessie Mayhew lay snoring in her double bed with the faded flannel sheets and vintage Sears mattress. She had taken 2 Benadryl caps last night to dry up her sinuses after a day of messing with ladies' mantle and hydrangeas. Hydrangeas always did something to her sinuses. They had drained like a tap as she plowed through people's yards, taking what she wanted without asking. She'd even ducked behind the Methodist chapel, where a thick hedge of hydrangeas flowered magnificently every year, and took her pick of the huge blooms. People knew who she was. They knew whose wedding this was. If she'd stopped to ask permission, they'd have said, "Help yourself. Take all you want." So why stop and ask? That was her philosophy. People should be proud for her to rogue their flowers, seeing they made so many people happy. "I declare," she once imagined someone saying, "Hessie Mayhew stripped every peony bush in my yard today, and I'm just tickled about it." For her money, the hydrangeas were a week shy of the best color. But did people who set wedding dates ever stop and think of such things? Of course not. They just went blindly on. If she lived to marry again, which she sometimes hoped she would, she'd do it in May, when Lily of the Valley was at its peak. On her screened porch, a decrepit porcelain bathtub boasted a veritable sea of virgin's bower and hydrangeas. In her double kitchen sink, blue mist spirea, autumn anemone, Queen Anne's lace, artemisia, and knotweed drank thirstily. Inside the back door, buckets of purple coneflowers, autumn clematis, cosmos, and wild aster sat waiting. On the counter above the dishwasher, a soup pot of pink duet and white garden party roses mingled with foxtail grass, Jerusalem artichoke, dog hobble, and panicles of the richly colored pokeberry. A small butterfly that had ridden in, drugged on a coneflower, came to itself and visited the artemisia. At 7:30, Hessie Mayhew turned on her side, moaning a little due to the pain in her lower back, and though a team of helpers was due to arrive at 8, she slept on. In her home, a half mile from town, Puny Guthrie crumbled 2 dozen strips of crisp, center-cut bacon into the potato salad and gave it 1 last, heaving stir. Everybody would be plenty hungry by 6 or 6:30. And she'd made enough to feed a corn shuckin', as her grandpa used to say. She had decided to leave out the onions, since it was a wedding reception and very dressy. She'd never thought dressing up and eating onions were compatible. Onions were for picnics, and eating at home in the privacy of your own family. Because Cynthia and the father didn't want people to turn out for the reception and go home hungry, finger foods were banned. They wanted to give everybody a decent supper, even if they would have to eat it sitting on folding chairs from Sunday school. What with the father's ham, Miss Luella's yeast rolls, Miss Olivia's raw vegetables and dip, her potato salad, and Esther Bolick's three-layer orange marmalade, she didn't think they'd have any complaints. Plus, there would be 10 gallons of tea, not to mention decaf, and sherry, if anybody wanted any, but she couldn't imagine why anybody would. She'd once taken a sip from the father's decanter and thought it tasted exactly like aluminum foil, though she'd never personally tasted aluminum foil, except when it got stuck to a baked potato. She thought of her own wedding and how she had walked down the aisle on Father Tim's arm. She had felt like a queen, like she was 10 feet tall, looking at everything and everybody with completely new eyes. Halfway down the aisle, she nearly burst into tears. Then suddenly she soared above tears to something higher, something that took her breath away, and she knew she would never experience anything like it again. Later, when she called Father Tim, Father, she was struck to find she said it as if he really were her father. It wasn't just some religious name that went with a collar. Ever since that moment, she'd felt she was his daughter in a way that no one except herself could understand. And hadn't he been the one to pray that parade prayer that brought JoJo to the back door and into her life forever? She had been cleaning the downstairs rectory toilet when JoJo came to the back, because she hadn't heard him knocking at the front. When she saw him, her heart did a somersault because he was the cutest, most handsome person she'd ever seen outside of a TV show or magazine.
Father Tim said he might have a candy wrapper in the pocket of his brown pants if you could send it, please.
She knew immediately that this policeman had been raised right, saying please. Not too many people said please anymore, much less thank you. She thought it was a shame. She had invited him in and given him a glass of tea, and he perched on the stool where Father Tim sat and read his mail, and she went upstairs and looked in the father's brown pants pockets, and there it was, wadded up. Why anybody would want to carry around a wadded-up candy wrapper? "Excuse my apron," she remembered saying. She would never forget the look in his eyes.
"You look really good in an apron," he said, turning beet red.
She'd never been told such a thing, and had no idea what to say. She handed him the candy wrapper, and he put it in a little Ziploc bag, without taking his eyes off her. She thought she was going to melt and run down in a puddle. Then he bolted off the stool and was out the door and gone, and that was that. Until he came back the very next day, when she was cooking lima beans.
"Hey,"
she said, through the screen door as he bounded up the steps. By now, she knew that the whole police force was working on the big jewel theft at Lord's Chapel.
"You are under arrest," he said,
blushing again. For a moment she was terrified that this might be true. Then she saw the big grin on his face.
"What are the charges?" "Well..."
He dropped his head and gazed at his shoes. She thought it must be awful to be a grown man who blushed like a girl. He jerked his head up and looked her in the eye.
"You're over the legal limit of being pretty,"
she giggled.
"What are you going to do about it?"
Boy, howdy, that had flown right out of her mouth without even thinking.
"Going to ask you to a movie in Wesley? How's that?"
"Is it R? I don't see R."
"I don't know," he said, appearing bewildered.
"You could look in the newspaper.
A call,"
she said. She could scarcely get her breath. She had never noticed before that a police uniform looked especially good. It was like he was home on leave from the armed forces.
"Well, you see, PG-13?
"Depending."
Why on earth was she being so hard to get along with? Her mouth was acting like it had a mind of its own.
"My grandmother's the mayor,"
he exclaimed.
"That's nice," she said.
This was going nowhere. She felt she was fluttering around in space and couldn't get her toes on the ground. Suddenly realizing she was wearing her apron again, she snatched it up and over her head and stood there, feeling dumb as a rock.
"So, just trust me," he said. "We'll find a good movie if we have to go all the way to..."
He hesitated, thinking.
"Johnson City."
"Thank you," she said. "I'd enjoy going to the movies with you."
After he left, she felt so addled and weak in the knees that she wanted to lie down, but would never do such a thing in the father's house. She didn't even sit down on the job, except once in a while to peel peaches or snap string beans. She walked around the kitchen several times, trying to hold something in. She didn't know what it was. She ended up at the back door, where it suddenly came bursting out. It was a shout. She put the plastic cover on the potato salad bowl and smiled, remembering that she'd stood at the screen door for a long time, with tears of happiness running down her cheeks. Having had their flight canceled on Saturday due to weather, Walter and Catherine Cavanaugh arrived at the Charlotte airport at 11:35 a.m. Sunday morning, following a mechanical delay of an hour and a half at LaGuardia. They stood at the baggage carousel, anxiously seeking her black bag, which contained not only her blue file suit for the wedding, but the gift they'd taken great pains to schlep instead of ship.
"Gone to Charlottesville, Virginia," said the baggage claim authority, peering into his monitor. "How about that?"
From her greater height of 6 feet, Catherine surveyed him with a look capable of icing the wings of a 747.
"Sometimes they go to Charleston," he announced, refusing to wither under her scorn. He was used to scorn. Working in an airline baggage claim department was all about scorn.
Miss Sadie Baxter sat at her dressing table in her slip and robe, near the open window of the bedroom she'd occupied since she was 9 years old. The rain clouds had rolled away. The sun was shining, and the birds were singing. What more could any human want or ask for? She carefully combed the gray hair from her brush, rolled it into a tidy ball, and let it fall soundlessly into the waste basket that bore the faded decal of a camellia blossom. Where had the years gone? One day she'd sat here brushing hair the color of chestnuts, and the next time she looked up, she was old and gray. She remembered sitting on this same stool, looking into this same mirror, reading Willard Porter's love letter, and believing herself to be beautiful. "Willard," she whispered, recalling the letter she had committed to memory, the letter he wrote on her 21st birthday. "You may know that I am building a house in the village, on the green where Amos Medford grazed his cows. Each stone that was laid in the foundation was laid with the hope that I might yet express the loving regard I have for you, Sadie. I am going to give this house a name, trusting that things may eventually be different between us. I will have it engraved on a cedar beam at the highest point in the attic, with the intention that its message may one day give you some joy or pleasure. Perhaps, God willing, your father will soon see that I have something to offer and relent. Until then, dear Sadie, I can offer only my fervent love and heartfelt devotion." Soon afterward, Willard had been killed and buried in France, and many years went by before she learned the name he had engraved on the beam. "For lo, the winter is past," she murmured, gazing from her window into the orchard. Learning the name, Winter Past, had indeed given her much joy and pleasure. The rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth. The time of the singing of birds is come. The time of the singing of birds had come for the father and Cynthia. Miss Sadie looked into the mirror and smiled. Yes, it was their time now. At 4:15, Cynthia urged Catherine to give her a few minutes alone. So much had gone on in the last days and weeks, she said, that she was quite breathless.
"What if you should fall down the stairs?"
Catherine inquired. "And your hair? It's still in curlers." Cynthia had known Catherine for just under 2 hours, but already reckoned her to be a woman who minced no words. "I'm not going to fall down the stairs," she said, "and the curlers come out in a flash. I must say you look smashing in Olivia's suit. Really, you do. The color is wonderful on you."
"I've never worn anything this short in my life," fumed Catherine, peering into the full-length mirror and tugging at her skirt. "I look exactly like Big Bird. I had no idea I was so knock-kneed. I'll scandalize the church. Your friends will think we're riffraff."
"They'll think no such thing. They've all been dying to meet you." Cynthia urged Catherine toward the door of her bedroom, the bedroom that would, tonight, belong to Walter and Catherine, who currently had no room of their own at all, poor souls.
"I'll take your bouquet out of the parish hall refrigerator," said Catherine, "and see you in the narthex."
What could she do with a bride who wanted to be alone?
As for herself, she had sprained her ankle 20 minutes before her own wedding, and if friends hadn't surrounded her, she might still be lying by the fish pond at that dreadful hotel in the Poconos. At 5 till 5, Father Tim shot his French cuffs and exchanged meaningful glances with Walter and the bishop. They were cooped into the 6-by-8-foot sacristy like 3 roosters, he thought, and not a breath of air stirring. He walked to the door and pushed it open. Avis Packard's cigarette smoke blew in.
"Excuse me," said Avis, peering into the sacristy at what he considered a sight for sore eyes.
There was their Pope, dolled up in a long white robe and the oddest-looking headgear he ever laid eyes on, not to mention that long stick with a curve at the end, which was probably for snatching people up by the neck when they dozed off in the pew. Avis took a deep drag off his filtered pell-mill and threw it in the bushes. At precisely 5 o'clock, Father Tim heard the organ. What was going on? Why hadn't anyone come to the outer sacristy door to tell them the bride had arrived?
"Don't go out there," he nearly shouted, as the bishop's hand went for the door that led to the sanctuary.
"Walter, please find Catherine. Find out what's going on." Somebody had missed a signal somehow. He felt oddly uneasy. At 5 after 5, Walter reappeared, looking mystified.
"Catherine can't find Cynthia. She was supposed to meet her in the narthex at 5 till.
10 minutes late. Cynthia Coppersmith was the very soul of punctuality. He had a gut feeling, and it wasn't good.
"I'll be back," he said, sprinting through the open door.
"I'll come with you," said Walter.
"No, stay here."
He dashed up Old Church Lane, cut through Baxter Park, and hit her back steps running.
"Cynthia!"
He was trembling as he opened the unlocked door and ran into the hall. He stood for a moment, panting and bewildered, as Violet rubbed against his pant leg. He wished he could find cats more agreeable. He took the stairs, 2 at a time, and hung a left into her bedroom.
"Cynthia!"
"Timothy!" She was beating on her bathroom door from the inside. "Timothy! I can't get out!" He spied the blasted doorknob lying on the floor. He picked it up and stuck the stem back in the hole and cranked the knob to the right, and the door opened and he saw his bride in her chenille robe and pink curlers, looking agonized.
"Oh, Timothy!"
"Don't talk," he said. "Don't even tell me. How can I help you? What can I do?"
She raced to the closet and took out her suit.
"I already have my pantyhose on, so I'm not starting from scratch. Stand outside and I'll do my best. Pray for me, darling." "Oh, I'm so sorry. I should have borrowed something blue for good luck. What a dreadful mess."
He stood in the hall and checked his watch. 5:17. Violet rubbed against his ankle. He felt his jaws beginning to lock.
"Okay. You can come in now. I have my suit on. Where are my shoes? Oh, good grief, how did they get there? I can't believe this, Timothy. I couldn't help it. The knob just fell off. I yelled out the window and nobody heard. It was awful.
Don't talk, he said, coming into the room. Why was he commanding her not to talk? Let the poor woman talk if she wanted to. Helpless, that's what he felt. She thumped onto the bench at her dressing table and powdered her face and outlined her lips with a pencil and put on lipstick. 5:20. Then she did something to her eyebrows and eyelids. 5:22. She sprayed the wisteria scent on her wrists and rubbed them together and touched her wrists to her ears. He could see Stuart pacing the sacristy, Catherine wringing her hands, Walter going berserk, the entire congregation getting up and walking out, the ham covered by saran wrap abandoned in the refrigerator. Cynthia!
Oh, dreadful, oh, horrid, she cried, finishing her mascara with a shaking hand. And I just remembered, you're not supposed to see the bride before the ceremony.
Too late, he said, eyeing his watch. 5:24.
I'm coming.
She got up and dashed toward him. Curlers, he said, his jaws cranking still further into the lock position.
Rats!
She plucked curlers from her head like so many feathers from a chicken and tossed them into the air. They literally rained around the room. He'd never seen anything like it.
No time to brush.
She looked into the mirror and ran her fingers through her hair. There, best I can do. God help me. She turned to him now, and he felt a great jolt from heart to spleen. She was so astonishingly beautiful, so radiant, so fresh, it captured his very breath. Thanks be to God, his custard was back. She grabbed her handbag from the chair.
We can take my car.
No place to park.
So, she cried as they headed for the stairs, race you.
Chapter 9. The Wedding. In the ninth row of the epistle side, next to the stained-glass window of Christ carrying the lost lamb, Hope Winchester blushed to recall her once ardent crush on Father Tim. She'd taken every precaution to make certain he knew nothing of it, and now it seemed idiotic to have felt that way about someone twice her age. She remembered the fluttering of her heart when he came into the bookstore, and all her hard work to learn special words that would intrigue him. She would never admit such a thing to another soul, but she believed herself to be the only person in Mitford who could converse on his level. When she'd learned about Cynthia months ago, she had forced herself to stop thinking such nonsense altogether, and was now truly happy that he and his neighbor had found each other. They seemed perfect together. Still, on occasion, she missed her old habit of looking for him to pass the shop window and wave, or stop in, and she missed pondering what book she might order that would please and surprise him. It wasn't that she'd ever wanted to marry him, for heaven's sake, or even be in love with him. It was just that he was so very kind and gentle, and made her feel special. Plus, he was a lot like herself, deep and sensitive. Not to mention, a lover of the romantic poets she'd adored since junior high. Early on, she had made it a point to read Wordsworth again, weeping over the Lucy poems, so she could quote passages and dig out morsels to attract his imagination. "Come in, out of the fretful stir," she once said, as he popped through the door at happy endings. He had looked up and smiled.
"Wordsworth!" he exclaimed, obviously pleased.
How many people would recognize two little words among a poet's thousand? She had felt positively thrilled. Opening her purse, she examined the contents for the Kleenex she'd stuffed in at the last minute. Though she thought it fatuous to cry at weddings, she deemed it wise to be prepared. In the fourth row of the epistle side, Jean Bolick wondered what on earth was going on. His watch said 5:15. He knew Richard well enough to know he was looking pale after hammering down on the organ all this time with nothing happening. He glanced again at the bishop's wife, whose head was bowed.
Was she praying that the father hadn't chickened out at the last minute? Wouldn't that be a corker if their priest was on a plane bound for the Azores? He didn't know where the Azores were located, but figured it was a distance. Realizing his fists were clenched and his palms sweaty, he forced his attention to the 3-layer orange marmalade sitting in the parish hall refrigerator, looking like $1 million. He hoped to the Lord the temperature was set right and hadn't accidentally been switched to extra cool, which had once frozen 200 pimento cheese sandwiches as hard as hockey pucks. He nudged Esther, who appeared to be sleeping under the brim of the hat she wore only to weddings and funerals. Esther was not sleeping. She was thinking, and ignored the nudge. Didn't she deserve to sit and catch her breath until these people got their act together and got on with it? She was thinking that maybe she'd put in too much sugar,